the sound of praise for your Sunday morning.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Introducing Reverend A.R. Bernard of the Christian Cultural Center.
Was the son of a preacher man.
And Rabbi Joseph Potasnik of Religion on the Line.
The only one who could ever teach me.
Now, on Talk Radio 77 WABC, here's the Rev and the Rabbi, where faith matters.
Good morning, I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
Reverend, we have live in the studio someone we've come to know and admire for a number of years. I'm talking about Elder David Buckner of the Area 70 of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I get all that title right?
You got it exactly right.
You know, we were talking before we went on the air about sitting together at a table, an interfaith table. There's a lot of talk now about breaking bread together, bringing people who may not have had the best of relationships closer to one another. Do you have any limitations on that kind of conversation? Is there a prerequisite before you sit down with someone at a table?
You know, it depends on who you talk to, because there are those who can't get beyond doctrinal differences, and they tend to be in a tension between doctrine and practice, because when it comes to practice, they have to build relationships and find common ground. So our congregation, and we're non-denominational, we find it easy to find common ground, and we're not threatened by any that have a difference in doctrine.
We find that we have a lot more in common than we have different. And when you look for commonalities rather than differences, alignment is a lot easier. And in a world that is discombobulated and confused and chaotic, it's the commonalities that you really want to be able to find. And so when I sit at the table, I don't limit by tribe or by limit titles or anything else that somebody might establish as this is who they are. I want to know them. And I come to find out when you know them, there's a lot more in common.
Yeah, and I think that commonality is not just on social issues. It's theological, because we all and should begin with the life and dignity of the human person. When someone's in crisis, I'm not going to screen them and ask, you know, well, what religion are you?
I think I have one prerequisite. I know I have one prerequisite, and that is you respect my right to live as a Jew. If you don't have that, then where are we going with this conversation?
But I'm going to challenge you on that. You're in a car accident. You're injured. Someone comes along, right? And they're there to help you. You're not going to screen them.
No, that's different. That's not sitting down to have a conversation. That's a life or death situation. That's a health.
But there are people who won't sit down and have a conversation because of the differences, even if it was a scenario like I just presented.
Well, but I say I can have that conversation, providing you accept my right to live as a Jew, as a conversation. And if you don't, what is there to talk about? I have to convince you of my right to live as a Jew? So I think basically it comes to respecting the other, the life and dignity of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Respect my right. I respect your right. That to me is the sine qua non. Without that, I don't know where else we're going to go.
So you wouldn't sit with me and have a conversation and find out why I don't believe you have a right to exist or the state of Israel?
It would be a very difficult thing for me to do, because I believe that in a world today that is so replete with conflict, that we have to recognize there are certain conditions. You want to live in peace with someone, you have to recognize that person's life to live in peace as well. It's very hard.
Yeah.
But at a foundational level, I think I'd want to know if you could teach me. If you and I are so different that I don't see or understand the differences from the outset, I'm not open to learning.
Yeah.
If we can sit down and I know that the very foundation, you're a human being, I'm a human being, we respect a God, deity matters. Now, teach me. And if you can teach me, even if I come with a bias or something quite different, I think we're both made better off by the conversation rather than saying the conversation can't be
had. Yeah, but there's still a willingness to hear the other.
Well, see, that's just it. They have a willingness.
There's a willingness to hear the other.
And you do understand that you're outnumbered for this broadcast,
I see that. This is
where, just letting you know.
You know, I usually am a minority. I'm accustomed to that. You wouldn't know about that, AR. But today I really feel it, and I see it. Look, I just think the time has come when people have to broaden their view and look at the other as one who has a spiritual birth certificate entitled to sit at the table and to live their belief as long as they don't look to destroy your belief.
Yeah, yeah. I think there are people who have grown up in a particular context that has shaped their worldview, their understanding not only of themselves but of the other, who are sincerely open to hearing the other's perspective. So I would not immediately dismiss a person if they had the right motive to sit down at that table as a table of understanding and dialogue. Yeah.
But if the person is determined to destroy me, what am I going to sit and discuss? What time are you going to destroy me? I mean, I think there has to be a certain fundamental appreciation of another human being as a child of God and a willingness to hear what that person has to say.
I might go one step further and say if they're willing to sit down, that's a step number one. Because if they are willing to sit down, that means that there is an open. There's an opening that's possible. If I hear, as you say, immediately that I'm discarded, disregarded, set aside. We see this in the Commission of Religious Leaders where we spend some time. There are a lot of different voices there. And for someone who came, first of all, into the room to observe, then was invited to sit at the table, then given a voice, each time I learned what it meant for each step along the way. And it was everyone at that table that looked at the center of the table with issues that were real to the city of New York, and not issues about theology or doctrine or differences. I find more commonality at that table than I sometimes find in my own religious family, because we're looking to solve, if not solve, give voice to the challenges of New York City.
There's a willingness to hear you, what you had to say about certain issues. So
yeah, I don't think a person who's not willing to hear the other's perspective is going to sit down at a table anyway. But let's elevate it. How do we engage in peace talks? How do we bring individuals together? Especially when you look at the state of Israel, you look at what's going on there. How do we get to the place where we can talk some kind of peace? And we use the word peace in a very fragile way because essentially it's trade-offs.
Look, I think if you look at Israel, using that as the example, there have been many sit-downs. There have been many discussions, many proposals for peace. But when you have the person who says in a charter publicly, destroy the Jews, I don't understand that conversation. Where are we going with it? I think there's got to be a recognition that I want to sit with you because I want to find a way that we can live side by side in some meaningful relationship, some hopefully a peaceful relationship, not to begin with, I want to destroy you. Mm-hmm. I think otherwise, you know, look, when we pray for peace in Jewish tradition, the custom is you take three steps back. God who creates peace in the heavens, grant peace to us, Israel, and the entire world. But you step back because it says you want to have peace. You got to step back and be ready to hear the other person. But if you're starting with, there's no room for you, I'm going to destroy you, that conversation to me is a non-starter.
Well, you bring it into our tradition. We celebrate these words every Christmas in our faith tradition. Peace on earth amongst men of goodwill. There'll be no peace unless people are coming to the table with goodwill.
I agree, 100%.
I also think that people who have a responsibility to report to a higher power are much more aligned with figuring out how to come together. People who don't have that are looking across the table and negotiating in a secular term. Mm. When I look at you, I see a man of God. When I look at you, I see a man of God. I see a higher power that brings us together and says, as long as we're looking to that higher power, however it may appear, as long as we're looking to that higher power, we at least have a foundation upon which we can stand. If I'm looking at each different theology or even differences when you're looking at the secular world, then I'm seeing you're right, I'm wrong, rather than we're looking for higher power and knowledge. And to me, that's what unites us.
And isn't that what religion is? It is a belief, a set of beliefs about the world in which we live, how we should interact with each other, what it means to be human, but also answering to what we consider to be ultimate reality. So it has to transcend our human feelings to a greater reality that controls us.
So why, if that being the case, why is religious history replete with so much bloodshed?
I think it's because they look across the table.
Yeah.
I think it's because they define their understanding of deity as superior to someone else's understanding of deity. When I look across the table at Reverend Bernard, and he's had conversations with me where I'm sure we have differences in our theological understanding, but we're both looking at needs. We're looking at God's desire for us. That's what unites us. So, and it's the world that gets across the table rather than looking above the table.
Well, you're looking at the person directly, but you're looking at a higher purpose as well.
Yeah.
It's a hybrid, so to speak. Talk about your theology. Talk about the church, because you know there have been many misconceptions about it, and you've been asked this 1,000 times. Tell us some of the pillars of your tradition.
I remember when I was walking in front of my own church on 65th and Columbus, Upper West Side of New York. It's been about 12 years ago. There was a lot of election conversation. The candidate running at the time was a member of my faith. And I had a reporter come up to me and say, "So, are you Christian?" And I stood there and I pointed to the sign that said, "The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints." Okay. And they looked at me like, "So?" I think one of the greatest misconceptions is that we're not Christian. Now, there are those who define Christianity certain ways. I get that. But I'm a follower of Christ. As a Messiah, when I was in Israel, I recognized seated at the table with my Jewish rabbi friends and seated with Christians to talk of Christ the way I know could be disparaging or at least dismissive. So what I said is we all seek the Messiah. For some, the first time. For others, we seek it the second time. And I started to realize there's a commonality. We all go back to Abraham.
There was
the unity of it all.
Yeah, but how your faith was delivered to you becomes the question, you see. And that's the distinction between Latter-day Saints and, let's say, some other Protestant denomination. How that faith was delivered.
But because we didn't accept Christ as the Messiah, we accepted Christ as a great teacher, a great leader, we Jews, we paid a price for that. There wasn't room for theological difference. If you look back at history, we were accused of a number of things, but our non-belief in Christ as a Messiah cost us dearly.
Scripturally, think about this. The majority of Christians, early Christians, right, they were Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The Gentiles came in much later in the church's experience and history. So it was considered a Jewish sect until it continued to grow. And then they had to wrestle through the relationship between this newfound grace in Christ and the law, Jewish tradition, versus the embracing of a much larger body into that foundational faith of Judaism.
But that wrestling with the different traditions was costly. It wasn't just a theological wrestling. It was translated into physical punishment because we didn't accept another's belief.
Interpretations. Now we get into hermeneutics.
You're not wrong with this exception. If you were to look at most faith traditions, never to the degree that you experience individually, but every faith organization, entity, and tradition has experienced something.
Mm-hmm.
Ours was minuscule compared to what we look like historically, but we were cast out. We were thrust out from the east to the west, and there was an extermination order declared in Missouri to kill all then Mormons. My point to that is not about what that encompassed, but the idea that every faith tradition has seen a period of time in which they pay a price for their faith,
mm-hmm.
whatever it may be.
Doesn't that mm-hmm. contradict the teachings of our tradition? Well, it doesn't say kill another because the other has a different belief.
Well, again, it goes back to doctrine, what we actually teach and what we practice.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, here in America, we are still experiencing the polarization, the division that goes back to the Civil War. You know, so we're talking about a very specific doctrine that is reflected in our Constitution in terms of the value for human life and certain rights that are ascribed to every human being. And yet, in practice, you know, we had to go through a period of abolishing slavery and then going into Jim Crow and segregation and continued marginalization. So that's very, very real.
Yeah. But I always say the movie and the book often contradict one another. We preach one thing, and in practice we see another.
Yeah, yeah.
And that to me is what's always been, that's been thrown at us years ago. You people of faith, you tell us how to behave. Well, look at your behavior over the years. You certainly weren't practitioners of what you preached.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, I'm here on earth to figure it out. I'm not here because I got it figured out, yeah, right? This is the process of becoming. And I think part of my life journey is to become. That's why I find this so rich, being with you, my friends, my brothers, because it helps me become more of what I need to be. Our two commandments, as we look at it in Christianity, of loving God, teaches us how to love our fellow men. Mm-hmm. In the secular society, it's about loving your fellow men almost first. And because of that, you never get the model for what it really could be. If I knew how God loved and I could love as he does, can you imagine what our relationship of love would be? The miracles that we could actually engage in and perform. Well, because we don't do that. We look across the table secularly and we say, are you loving me as much as I love you?
Yeah.
Rather than am I loving you as God?
That's
would
a scary notion, to love like God loves. That's a tough one.
But I'm learning.
Again, that's a high bar.
That's that's where practice can be in conflict with doctrine, because we are taught to love God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and we're taught to love our neighbor in the same way. And we suffer from an inability to love like that, and at the same time, a desire to love and be loved like that. We live in a tension between the ideal and the reality.
Yeah.
Our doctrine presents the ideal, life presents the reality, and we live in a tension between those two.
And we also have to recognize that to go from the ideal to the real is not one step.
Yeah.
It's a process, right? Yeah. And it's a journey throughout our lives. We always seek to be better.
That's life.
That's what life is.
That's becoming.
You're not going to be, like people say, you're the best. I always think, that's wonderful. How did I get to be the
best? You are the best.
Right? In 30 seconds.
Yeah.
When we say religiously, you're the best, that's a goal. But right now, you need to be better.
I think without straining the text and violating any laws of hermeneutics, I think back to the original expression that when God took spirit and placed it in body, breathing into it, he became a living soul. And that's interesting because it speaks of a process towards an ultimate goal in the mind of God.
Isn't it interesting, after each day of creation, it says, and God saw it was good.
Mm.
Didn't say the best. Didn't say, I can't do better than this. It was good. Now it's your responsibility to take it to a different level like that. It's a human responsibility.
I get more sermons from him. I don't give him credit, but I do get sermons from him.
Before we go to a guest, I just want to say this to you, and Reverend Bernard and I have remarked about it many times. The good works that your church does in helping other people, in reaching out to those who need strength and support, especially during difficult times, I always hark back to Sandy and other calamities where you would see, you know, representatives of the Mormon church right out there wearing the yellow jackets coming forward. I remember when there was a horrific fire synagogue, there you were seeking to help. What is it? We all talk about the need to help, but you seem to be consumed with that spirit of we cannot be who we need to be unless we help others be better.
It's a gracious comment, and I genuinely appreciate it. I will say this. There's two parts to that. One is we can do nothing without you. And what I mean by that is you know where the needs are. We have found here in New York City this last holiday time, 42,000 children were helped because you, talking about large religious institutions, knew where the needs were. So the partnership of people of faith, I think, inspires all of us to do more. That's one. I think, two, there is a doctrinal belief that by their fruits you shall know them.
Mm.
I'm a big believer in that. If I don't live my faith, and I'm still figuring it out, but if I don't live my faith, if I don't try to become more, I lose out on the purpose of life.
There was a prophet who said that, Habakkuk. He said the most important, if you look at all the commandments, probably the most important would be a person has to live his faith.
Yeah. Let me say something. You brought up a very important point, and that is Elder Buckner and his organization and his faith tradition and their commitment to working together, building bridges. You remember the mass shooting that took place at Topps Supermarket
in Buffalo.
And it was one of many mass shootings in crisis. Well, we were in conversation with the governor, with the mayor, and we were talking about what could we do as an organization. And I will tell you, Elder Buckner stepped up, and we coordinated through LDS, through him, two truckloads of food. I think it was 5,000 pounds of food. And we took staff and volunteers and young people. We connected with Bishop Pridgen, who was the president of city council. We've had him on the broadcast. Mm-hmm. And we were able to serve over 2,000 families and empower a local food pantry to continue the work after we left for the next several months. And that's the kind of partnership that looks at a need and works together in spite of doctrinal differences.
I find two things. One, when I see others who are responding as munificently as the both of you have, it tells me I have to do more as well. And if you look, for example, Israel, whenever there is a global tragedy anywhere, it could be a country where there are no relations with Israel. Israel, a host of human rights organizations from Israel, responds immediately, puts their lives in danger. And to me, that's the religious thing to do.
Yeah, that's right? Doctrine and practice, orthodoxy and orthopraxy.
You know, Martin Luther King said years ago, probably the most important question is, what are you doing for others? And I think all of us have to ask ourselves, in being people of faith, what are we doing for other people? We're going to have a guest in a few moments who has an amazing story to tell.
Always amazing. The adventures
of. I want his frequent flyer miles. You know, I'm talking about Pastor William Devlin. So let's stay tuned for more of
The Rev and the Rabbi right here on 77 WABC.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Tasman.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard.
And we have with us Elder David Buckner.
That's right.
You know, this is a
co-anchor.
Yeah.
Honor to be
does
here.
Does this mean one of us is out? I mean, I didn't want to break the news to you, Rev, but, you know.
Not likely.
You know, a lot of Christians
you're
in this
outnumbered
room
today.
We're used to it. Trust me on this one. You can have all the diversity in the world. We're still not there. We have Pastor William Devlin, who, as you know, is a very, very special. He's a unique person.
That's a better word.
Yeah.
Unique.
You know, I remember saying to his wife once, he's never home. She says, so what's wrong with that? That's what keeps a marriage together when people are apart for a while. But Bill Devlin, you have traveled to more dangerous places than anyone I know. You just came back from Nigeria. Talk about why you went and what you saw.
Yeah, and thank you, Reverend Dr. A.R. Bernard, and thank you, Rabbi Joe Potastic, and Elder. And you're right. I've been doing this full time for 11 years now. After God didn't send me out. He kicked me out of a great church in Manhattan, and I've been doing this full time for 11 years. 338, what I call God trips, to 20 war zones. I do approximately 32 trips a year. So if you do the math, then you get 338. And my recent trip to Nigeria is just out of a heart of compassion for the Nigerian Christians in the north. The south of Nigeria is relatively quiet, but the north part of Nigeria, where the 12 states have implemented Sharia law over the years, I call it the killing fields of planet Earth. Nigeria is now the most dangerous place on planet Earth to be a Christian believer. And over the last 10 years, there's been upwards of 20,000 Christian believers that have been murdered. Now, if I may get graphic for a moment, Boko Haram, Islamic State, West Africa province, and the Fulani jihadist herdsmen, this is not a battle between, as our U.S. State Department says, between herders and farmers. This is all about the Islamization of Nigeria. So I've been there now 15 times in the last 3 years. And every time we go and we meet with the victims, these are widows who have seen their husband and children beheaded. You know, Boko Haram says we don't waste our bullets on infidels, meaning the Christian believers. So they behead them or they hold them down and make the women and children drink antifreeze. And so then they die a terrible death a couple of days later. When I was there on Christmas Day, I was actually speaking at a church in northern Nigeria, in a place called Madala, Niger State, a bit north of Abuja, the federal capital. And while we were commemorating, I was speaking at St. Teresa's Catholic Church, while we were commemorating a suicide bombing from Boko Haram 12 years prior on Christmas Day 2012, we were basically weeping with the 1,000 members of that church who had lost 26 souls that day. One father that we had met with a couple of years ago lost all four of his daughters, a 23-year-old, two twin 17-year-olds, and a 13-year-old. While we were there, gentlemen, we didn't realize this, but just to our north and east, 2 hours, 200 Christian believers were being murdered on Christmas Day. So the jihadist Islamist terrorists know that Christmas Day and Easter, these churches are soft targets. They're generally unprotected. And even the Nigerian army had a 12-hour tip-off that this Boko Haram murderous regime was going to come in. And the army stood down, and then the army took 12 hours to get there. So we know, unfortunately, and I say this boldly, that the Nigerian government is in collusion with these Islamists and jihadists. And sadly, 2 years ago, the current U.S. administration dropped Nigeria as what's called a CPC, or a country of particular concern. And recently, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which is a bipartisan congressional side of religious freedom, different than the Religious Freedom Office at the State Department, the Congressional Religious Freedom Office, made up of Dems and Republicans, they excoriated the recent report that Secretary Blinken and the U.S. State Department put out, saying that, well, Nigeria doesn't need to be on the country of particular concern. So this is killing fields in Nigeria. That's why I continue to go. We're in the process. I was donated 400. Our organization, widowsandorphans.info, was donated $400,000 of humanitarian supplies. We're actually negotiating with the World Food Program and the United Nations Humanitarian Air Service to get those goods over there to help the displaced people as a result of this invasion and this murderous
Right. I was just going to say, but this is not new. I was in Kano. Right. I was in Lagos. I was in Kaduna in the 90s. And I don't know if you remember, they were bombing the oil pipelines at the time. And we saw while we were there a strong movement of Islamic religion and that faith coming in. And supposedly Nigeria was a Christian nation. So here we are, you know, 2-3 decades later, and we're seeing either the same thing or I think there's a greater hostility.
There is a greater hostility, Reverend Dr. A.R. Bernard. And in fact, when Muhammad Buhari, the former president, when he left in May of 2023 after the election, and then Tinubu came in, the new president, over 400 Christians were murdered by machete, by forced drinking of antifreeze and some bullets and burnings of homes and schools. They'll just put, 300 people in a church or a school and burn it down. Mm-hmm. That the Boko Haram said that that was an outgoing present, as in a gift, to the President Buhari that was outgoing. So 38 villages in Jos Plateau State, where you have been, Reverend Dr. A.R., and it now it's at a heightened level because the Islamists are in collusion with the government more so than any other time in the history of Nigeria.
Yeah.
And it's encroached down from the northern states of Sokoto and other of the Sharia law where it rules. And now it's continuing to march forward in this murderous path, this murderous juggernaut down into Abuja.
But how are the Christian churches responding? Because Nigerian has a strong Pentecostal, especially, and charismatic Christian presence there. How are they responding to all this?
Well, and that's the ultimate question. Unfortunately, the Southern Nigerian church, which has mega churches, and it's just amazing how there's a church on every corner, as you know, Doctor, in Lagos and in other Southern Nigeria cities. There seems to be an obsolescence. It's like an ignorance of what's going on up north. Myself and my Northern Nigerian colleagues have met with these pastors, and we've pleaded with them and said, well, you know, you've got to stand up for your Northern Nigerian sisters and brothers. And at this point, they refuse to do that because they say, well, you know, we're okay. They're not going to come. And we appeal to them. If not us, then who? And if not now, then when?
Hmm.
So there is an absolute, and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, gentlemen, that the Southern Nigerian church is not paying any attention to the Northern Nigerian church. And by the way, there's no means of protection because it's illegal to own a gun in Nigeria. I've met with many of the legislators, the senators and Congress people over there, and they say we're stymied because right now the Nigerian Christians are protecting themselves with slingshots.
Reverend
but
Devlin,
the
story you tell is compelling in that we're seeing, as we look back 30 years, that the changes have not occurred. This is Elder Buckner, and I'm just curious, as you've looked at this and the number of trips you've taken, I mean, 338, I mean, this is more boots on the ground, if you will, experience. As you look at this, is there, and I'm going to go above the transactional challenges, I want to look at people of faith and differences they can make. You've identified the people of the South, and the Christian followers there are not attentive to or not influencing the North. Here's my question. We're seeing in our own faith that Nigeria is growing exponentially. We're seeing Christians that are finding their faith. They're looking for a foothold in their faith. Do you see the potential for that to move further north and people of faith becoming more emboldened, more compassionate, more humanitarian? Or do you see that this is going to keep pushing from the north? The reason I'm asking is we were talking earlier about how religion has often been at the crux of at the center of war and conflict. Is there possibility that you see where hope and faith and religiosity, if you will, can actually overcome what's being seen in the horrific stories that you're sharing?
Great question. The Northern Nigerians are fleeing out of Northern Nigeria because there's absolutely no protection. A group that we work with, which is a nationwide Christian organization called CAN, Christian Association of Nigeria, they put out statements, but they're really not doing anything to advocate at the federal government level. So the movement is not south to north. The movement is north to south.
But what about faith? I mean, when I think about faith, and I'm not trying to simplify it. But what about faith over transactional? When you talk about government, you talk about, you know, transactional support. I can drop food loads of rice, but that doesn't solve for the hunger.
Right.
What are you seeing in terms of faith?
Yeah. Well, the Northern Nigerian Christians have been emboldened. I mean, I've talked to people who have had men, a brother I'm thinking of now, Nathaniel, he had half his face blown off. I've met with women who have seen their husbands beheaded in their home. and then they're dragged out, and then their home is burned down. So their faith is strong, their faith is emboldened, and they are relentless in sharing the love of Jesus. And yet they also say, well, what future do I have in northern Nigeria?
So, Pastor Bill, because I don't want the opportunity to pass, you see what's going on in South Africa, bringing Israel into the international court arena, accusation of genocide.
Right.
Right? Which I think is so unfair because Israel is defending its right to live as a Jewish state. Why isn't Nigeria being brought into an international court because of its decision to exterminate so many Christians?
Yeah, well, and by the way, in response to the elder as well, my passion is to go. You know, in Matthew chapter 28, Jesus didn't say, stay and pray. He said, go. Go into all the world and preach his message. So my passion 11 years ago is God gave me three words, God, gospel, good news. Take the first two letters of all three of those words and go. So I dropped everything. I rearranged my life. I went home and told Nancy and five kids and 12 grandkids. I said, I'm going over to the persecuted lands and places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, etc. So I think the important message that I want people to hear on the Reverend the Rabbi at WABC Radio today is we've got to go. The time has ended. The time has ended for people of faith in the West to just stay and pray and give money. We've got to go to these places. And the reason that Nigeria is not being before the International Criminal Court of Justice is because they have a lot of sway. They're the most populous nation in Africa, 230 million people, and they're a economic engine for really all of Africa. I mean, I've been there enough over the last 3.5 years that they are really the shining star of Africa, along with places like Kenya. But there is no reason for anyone to bring Nigeria up on charges because they're afraid that Nigeria may cut off any oil supply. So there's a lot of geopolitical machinations.
So much for morality and the law.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
do I understand something? When Christians are being brutally massacred, when Muslims are being brutally massacred very often by other Muslims that we've seen in Syria, that doesn't get world attention.
Right.
Israel gets world attention.
Yeah.
I don't understand the disparity. There are more Christians than there are Jews. We can all agree on that. But what is it? Is it just the economic engine that's driving this kind of inequity?
Well, yeah, no question on the part of Nigeria. If Nigeria perhaps was some poor nation and their GDP was low, but it's amazing the economic engine that Nigeria is. So even our own administration, that's why they dropped the country of particular concern label, or even the there's another label called the special watch list. Nigeria is on none of them. But yeah, people come after Israel. And of course, my standard line, why are you going after Israel? Well, because the Jews are God's chosen people. That's exactly why they've been under attack for thousands of years. So and by the way, I've been to Israel, as you know, Rabbi, and gentlemen, 55 times. I've
more than Moses, 55 more than Moses.
Exactly. He didn't even get in.
Yeah, I know. That's why it's 55 more. Yeah.
But we understand that the role that Israel plays in geopolitics. I mean, they are the key ally for America in the Middle East. You know, we can't play that down. So whatever is going to happen with Israel is going to dominate the news cycle.
Yeah. Now,
even though 75% of religious persecution around the world is against Christians.
Yeah, but Pastor Devlin goes to Gaza and speaks about Israel. Am I right?
Certainly. In fact, I was just there on July.
And you're still 3rd. Here to talk about it. This is what amazes
yeah,
me.
Still here to talk
you're
about
like
it.
Superman.
And, you know, sadly, I mean, think about this statistic. There are 1.5 million Christians from the U.S. that go to Israel every year, you know, predominantly, well, of every stripe, Catholic, evangelical, Protestant, you know, the Baptist, the saints and the ain'ts, and 1.5 million go. But out of that 1.5 million, how many go to Gaza? Only three, myself and a pastor from North Carolina and a pastor from Amman, Jordan. So there again is a case of going. We need to go. Hey, if you're concerned about the 1,000 Gazan Christians, the Arab Christians that have been there since antiquity, we're talking probably 60 A.D., there's a church that was built in 400 A.D. It's still there. People still worship. There's a Catholic church, a Greek Orthodox church, and a Baptist church. And I've been to Gaza 33 times ministering to the oppressed Christians there. And I also meet, as you said, Rabbi, I meet with Hamas. I've been meeting with Hamas since 2010. And I've been sharing the love of God, of Jesus with yeah. them. And I've also said, look, Israel is not your problem. And by the way, there is no blockade in Gaza. People keep talking about a blockade. And those are the very people that have never been to Gaza. Yeah. I've been there at the southern end and the northern end. And when I exit Gaza, there are hundreds of Palestinian men and women going to Israel for jobs.
Right,
and
right.
there are Gazans on gurneys and wheelchairs that are going to Hadassah Hospital, Tel Aviv University Hospital, guess what, for free medical care.
Pastor so Bill, we got to stop you here because we yep. come to the end of the segment. Next time you go to Gaza, I will drive you. I will go with you to the airport. After that, you're on your own. Let me just say,
right.
I know my limitations on this one. Thank you so much. And, you know, it's always, you know, it's a learning experience when we speak with you.
Yeah, always
right.
a pleasure having you on the program.
Orphans.info. People can see widowsandorphans.info.
Wait, say that again. Say
thanks
that again.
And God bless.
Wait, one more time. That website. That
widows
website.
And, widows and Orphans.
andorphans.info. And God bless you. Shalom, shalom, Baruch Hashem. We'll talk soon.
All right, my
thank
friend.
You.
Always
right.
a pleasure to have you.
All
stay
right.
tuned
thank
for more of the
much.
Rev and the Rabbi.
You know, when you have Pastor Bill on the air, why do we have to be here? He can carry it on his own. He's good.
I'm trying to go through a break here. Okay? Stay tuned. We'll be back.
Where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Pastor.
And I'm Reverend A. Arthur.
We are joined with our guest today, Elder David Buckner, Area 70 of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You know, one of the things I'm learning from all of these discussions, and they're really very precious, is that the important role of faith in the public arena, that prophetic voice needs to be heard as loudly as possible.
Look, you and I have talked about the fact that religion brings a moral value consensus to society, which is necessary for concord, for peace, for justice, for cooperation. And I think that we do it differently here in the northeastern part of the United States. I actually took time to look at the United States by region and the role of interfaith and ecumenical dialogue. We are the most pronounced in the country here in the Northeast, not even on the West Coast, but here in the Northeast and especially New York State, that we engage in not just ecumenical dialogue, but interfaith dialogue, not just dialogue, but right. we actually work together
yeah.
Towards common goals. Yeah.
I think some of that may be historic. If you think about the Northeast being settled from the very beginning, they came many for religious purposes and diversity of faith. The rich texture that it provides, I don't think is always seen across the country and not across the globe. I celebrate. I've even had my own family saying, so you associate so much of your time is with people of different faiths. I said, because they're my family. It's the tapestry, and it weaves this rich connectivity because we believe in a higher purpose. And that brings us together in ways I don't think the rest of the world can understand the
you
benefits.
Know, I always tell my peeps, my people at the Board of Rabbis, we all have websites. And every website that I've seen for an organization has a mission statement. And I think it's important to read and reread your mission statement. So when you go in the morning saying, what am I here for? Is it just to have another meeting? Is it just to have, you know, more minutes taken? Or is it to do something about the condition of life today?
Yeah, I think also we have a strong focus here on social justice. And I think that's fueled by the diversity.
As you call it, tikkun olam.
Have here. Right? Tikkun olam, right, absolutely. Right. You taught me that. But the fact that we have a responsibility to make the world a better place, to not leave it the way we found it. So that piece of social justice, I think it fuels the kind of dialogue that we see, whether it's ecumenical or interfaith. And the difference between the two for our listening audience, you know, ecumenism is when within the context of, let's say, the Christian faith, we have Protestants, we have Catholics, we have Protestant sects as well. You know, that's talking to each other. But interfaith is where we have the relationship with the Muslims, with the Jewish community, with the Sikh community, with the Buddhist community.
And don't we get criticized sometimes for that? Don't people say by engaging in interfaith, you are somehow compromising your own identity? They're saying, you know, you go in there, you're not standing strong. Oh, I find on the contrary.
It's the contrary. You become stronger in what you do know and more compassionate in understanding what you don't know. And I will say this as a visitor, to observe the Rev and the Rabbi, to participate in the Rev, you are both very different. You, in the sense that you bring people together, you are constantly curious, you are uniting. Even the very presence of this radio conversation that you have is foundationally inclusive. And it's not just me. You listen to the voices here coming from very different backgrounds. You are bringing together because you're curious. You are deeply curious. And I think at the foundation of faith is curiosity, to ask questions. And that brings us together to learn from each other. And you're great examples of this. This isn't just about a radio show. This is two people who actually live that purpose.
I always wonder what our eulogies are going to sound like. But you know what also it is, Rev? You and I do this on the air. But off the air, it's that commitment that stands strong where we talk to each other and say, how are we going to move this forward?
Yeah, yeah. And we've been there for each other. In situations and circumstances that present themselves. In fact, that's why the Commission of Religious Leaders was formed. You know, it goes back to the 1950s and appears whenever there's been some type of crisis, and the religious leaders' voices, who are trusted voices within the community, come together and try to bring peace and order and a response. And the reconvening of the Commission of Religious Leaders was to bring us together.
You know, when people say, where is God in the midst of a tragedy? I always say, here they are.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
People who are people of faith. You take any crisis, and I'll show you people of faith who are in that arena doing as much as possible.
We sit around that table, Commission of Religious Leaders, and I see in the middle of the table the what-if questions. What if we could do this? What if we could do that? What if we were better at doing this? I never see division. I see unity in a way that every single city in this country, and I believe every place in the world, if they had a Commission of Religious Leaders that would bring people together, bring their voices, not just about one issue or another issue or a dogma or anything else, but about what ifs. Mm-hmm. The what ifs, and bringing voices of faith, of true faith, coming together, we could change the world.
And doesn't faith explore the possibilities? Faith is about hope. It's about believing that things can be better.
My mother, I remember quite often when I would ask her, there's someone at school who is far away, I want to bring him home. I never said, by the way, bring her home. I always say, bring him home. At that age, I wasn't going to go there. Can I bring him home for the holidays? And she said, Joe, there's always room for one more at the table. And I think that has been a mindset that has inspired me all these years. People of faith, we have to find room for the one more, especially the one more who's been left out. And I think we've done a good job, and now we need to do better.
But it also is reflected in our distaste for the extremes and for the manipulation of faith that creates the division that we are seeing and the polarization that we're seeing in our nation. This is going to be an interesting year, 2024. Because it's an election cycle.
And Rev, if the people of faith don't speak out properly, loudly, clearly. It's the extremes that have the voices.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're the ones who take over. So when people say, well, why did this happen? Well, you weren't there. You weren't part of the battle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been a great program. Great having you, Elder Buckner, from the 70th District of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints.
You're pretty close. It's an Area 70
area
of the Church
seven.
Of Jesus Christ.
Well, you know, Area 7.
Yeah, there are no Jews living in that area, right?
You're wonderful. You're truly my brothers, my family. And I'll tell you, with this year, we need to be in the public square.
Yeah.
We need to be united as a voice of faith.
It's going to be a volatile year. And thank you, our listeners, for always tuning in and giving as much grace as you can to the rabbi every week like you do.
I'm a work in progress.
We're all under construction. Yeah, yeah. Until next time, the Rev and the Rabbi, right here on 77 WABC.